Good afternoon. Thank you for your attention. Very much looking forward to our conversation today. Before we do that, I'm going to get a couple, do a couple housekeeping things here. Thank you for that attention. Continue, please, to enjoy your lunch. On behalf of, I'm Dan Gibbons from the City Club. On behalf of our Board of Governors, I'd like to welcome you. We have two of our governors here, Jackie Robinson Ivey and Kirk Dillard, are here with us. And we appreciate you being here. Kirk's fresh off of a trip to the Vatican, where he dialed into our board meeting last week. So we feel a little extra blessed today. We'll see how this goes. Welcome home. You saw earlier we were recognizing our civic level members, something new here that as we continue to reimagine different experiences at City Club, we want to make sure we thank those members and, of course, our sponsors, because that allows us to do what we do and have these great conversations with great public servants like the Attorney General. So thank you to those members. Thank you also to the sponsors today. There's a whole host of them, so if you hold your applause, we appreciate each and every one of you. Advocate Health, congratulations on your new opening I mentioned. Cozen O'Connor Public Strategies, Croak Fairchild Duarte and Barris, and Point of Different Strategies. Government Solutions Group over here, Illinois Attorney General's Office, of course, the Illinois Health and Hospital Association, the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council, the Sargent Consulting Group over here, World Business Chicago, APS and Associates, Loyola University Chicago, Metropolitan Peer and Exposition Authority, and Hometown Airline, United Airlines. Thank you to all of those sponsors. Very much appreciated. Mr. Attorney General, we have you have attracted an incredible crowd. We have an amazing representation here today of the civic community of Chicago and beyond. So as we always do, and for those of you who are new here, you may not understand, we try to give a sampling of who's in the room. Of course, we can't get to everybody, but we have philanthropy, we have education, we have business, we have, of course, especially today, law enforcement, public service, former public servants, all sorts of people that are doing great things to move this city and this state forward. So I'll just give you a sampling of those folks. Andy Biedman from the Pritzker Traubert Foundation is here. Robert Berlin, state's attorney of DuPage County. Thank you for coming this way. Kelly Burke, mayor of Evergreen Park, and state rep Kelly Burke right in front here. Loretta Clark from MPEA, also a sponsor today. Thank you, Loretta. Tom Cross from FH Passion. Douglas D. Podesta, the special agent in charge of the FBI Chicago office. Thank you and your team. Jim Durkin's here from Croak Fairchild. Julian Fairley from Amazon. Julian, thank you. Sarah Garza Resnick from Personal PAC. Rory Hoskins, Mayor of Forest Park. I think Mary Kenny is here, great civic leader and housing expert, although I didn't see her in person. Dan Lynch, thank you, Dan, from United, great another civic level member. John Maniff, the Assistant Special Agent in charge of the ATF. Again, thank you, thank you, thank you. We have a host of law enforcement experts and public servants here, and we very much appreciate all of your team and your efforts. Cindy Mullis from the Pritzker Traubert Foundation. Jamie Moster, who is the Kane County State's Attorney. Another state's attorney in the room. Let's see. Of course, I mentioned the Carpenters, Joel, Tony, Gary. I think a good crew of you here. Mark Reed is here, the president of Loyola University, also fresh off a meeting with the Pope. So I don't know if we're feeling it today. Thank you. Thank you, Mark, and all of your colleagues at Loyola. Betty Lou Salzman, the one and only legendary Betty Lou. Thank you for being back. And she's, of course, sitting next to Dwayne Duskins, another City Club regular and favorite. It's a great group of people. Deb Witzberg is here. And this is the first time Deb has been here in her new role as Chief of Staff to the Attorney General. Of course, she's graced us for years now as in her role as the Inspector General of Chicago. So congratulations to you in this new role, Deb. And thank you for all that you do for the city and for the state. I think I got, if there are any electeds or thank you for, especially to those public servants. I think that's a pretty good sampling. And I know the Attorney General is going to mention a few of these folks in some of his remarks and some of his questions. So let's get right to that. And please, if you join me in welcoming, you all know why you're here and who you're here to see. Lifelong Chicagoan. He's a former state senator. A great public servant for the state of Illinois. His job has been a little more intense these last couple of years. We're going to hear all about it. They play a critical role in protecting consumers, defending civil rights, and advocating for people all across our state. Please join me in welcoming our good friend, Attorney General Kwame Raoul, to the City Club of Chicago. Welcome back. This is becoming a tradition. It's been just over a year. I usually prepare by watching the last video. I didn't watch it last night because there was a basketball game on.
That's important.
I think I may have started though last year by saying, "Wow, what a year it's been." I'm going to do that again.
Yeah.
Wow, what a year it's been. You have been in the middle of fights. You've been in the middle of federal government in working with other states, with other attorneys general. We've had a lot of changeover in locally with law enforcement and folks in the judicial system. We have so much to discuss. What in this past year, and as we sit here today, what's top of mind for you? What's number one on your agenda? And then let's dig into a whole host of other topics if we can.
All right. Before I get to that, you had the job of giving shout-outs, and one person we omitted was Matthew Scarpino from the Homeland Security Investigation. So I just want to make sure I embarrassed him and gave him a good shout.
Thank you, and embarrassing to us. I'm sorry for that. We very much appreciate you, Matthew, and U.S. Customs Enforcement. Thank you, and we look forward to talking about this collaboration.
Yeah. So, I often get that type of question asked different ways. What's my top priority? What's top of mind? What are my top three priorities? And it's very difficult presiding over an office that's so multifaceted to say that, defending against overreach from the federal government is more important than collaborating with law enforcement partners to stop the flow of drugs and guns and to prosecute, help state's attorneys partners in prosecuting homicides to working collaboratively to protect against internet crimes against children, to fighting against monopolies that create higher costs and unfair competition for people in throughout the country. It's multifaceted, and it's very, and I left out a whole bunch, right? So there's so much. I'm just blessed to have the type of staff that I have, and some of which I have to credit my predecessor for recruiting, and some of which I take credit for bringing on. But one of the most important top of mind things, given that all the work that we achieve can't be done without, I get the credit all the time, but can't be done with the staff that I have, is the work we've done to try to retain that staff. I took over in 2019, and in 2018, the National Association of Attorneys General did a survey of attorney general's offices from throughout the country on retention. 48 states responded. We were number 48. So we were training a lot of lawyers to go be employed elsewhere. I've been aggressive about going to the legislature in the seven and a half years that I've been in office to appeal for investment in this office that returns over the course of my 7.5 years for every dollar of general revenue fund spent on the attorney general's office, we return $21. Anybody who has that in their portfolio is rich. We can't do this type of work without adequate investment. Unfortunately, at approximately 3 a.m. in the morning, a week ago Monday, we were shorted about $10 million from what our overall appropriation was for fiscal year 26. And I can't imagine why, what came about at 3 a.m. in the morning to make that disinvestment. But
it's interesting, especially when you put it in the context of the return on investment.
Had included the full, keeping us just flat, all iterations of it, all the way until 3 a.m. in the morning, had us fully funded. So I don't know.
Are they putting that towards the Bears Stadium?
I don't know.
That didn't seem to work.
Investment in Hammond.
that's interesting, because it's to me, I always see it as you have the day, I call it your day job. I mean, that's everything you talked about.
And I should explain that, by the way, because there, it can be characterized, and for those who have served in the legislature, they understand it. It can be characterized as a $5 million increase, because there was a $5 million increase in general revenue fund, but we're funded by both the general revenue fund and other state funds. Overall, it's a $10 million decrease from what we had to operate under last year. And again, I'm thankful for, you mentioned some folks from the philanthropic community who are here. I serve as co-chair of the Democratic Attorney General's Association, and there's an organization called Progressive State Leaders Committee that set up a fellows program for AG offices from around the country that fellows can come work in AG's offices. And the Chicago philanthropic community really stepped up to the plate. As a result, we have five fellows working hard, and these are really high pedigree attorneys that have come to our office and really made a significant contribution. So I really want to thank the Chicago philanthropic community for stepping up to the plate. You said Cindy Mullis was here. Big ups to Cindy for helping initiate
that. Hopefully they become part of that retaining pool of folks that we keep around here. That's great. You did also mention your team. I think many of them are here. If you could, please raise your hand if you are part of the Attorney General's team. We appreciate your service. You touched on a number of things, and I was saying that I kind of imagine your office and you as having your day job, all the things that are usually what you're supposed to be doing. You represent the legislature, you represent the governor, you represent the state, you're fighting internet crime, you're getting guns off the streets, you're working with state's attorneys, public corruption. There's an awful lot there. Then there seems to be this whole other job that
I'll call it federal accountability. With this current administration, there's an awful lot of battles happening between states, especially Illinois, and the federal government. How much of that is taking, here's your team's here, you're here, you've got partners. How much of that work is going towards this federal accountability work that you're doing?
It's difficult to quantify it because while we have fellows who work specifically largely on that work, we have folks from throughout the office who have other responsibilities who have dedicated a lot of their time to that work. We've watched it. We've all watched it over the course of the last year and a half. But really, our work started about 2 years ago, a little bit over 2 years ago, where a group of Democrat Attorney Generals Associated Attorney Generals came together, realizing Joe Biden was the presumed candidate for president at that time. So we kind of said, there's probably a chance that he might not win. And if he doesn't win, there had been some things promised and laid out in a document, Project 2025, that it could be devastating to Americans throughout, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or independents. And we divvied up subjects and started working on preparing for if that were to happen. It didn't start on January 20th of that year. It started months before that we started this work. That's where on day one with birthright citizenship, we were ready. And I was asked at a Senate Appropriations Committee hearing a couple of months ago, I think it was Senator DeWitt who asked me whether it was worth it to spend the resources that we were spending to be adverse to the federal government. Shouldn't we be working together with the federal government? I've always been talented at walking and chewing gum. Since day one, and I started during President Trump's first administration, I've actually worked hard to enhance our partnership with federal law enforcement partners, many of whom are here today, and we've achieved remarkable results together. That said, when different things are coming from Washington to try to coerce us to an agenda with federal funding, my answer to Senator DeWitt was that at the time when I answered that we have saved over $7 billion of funding for the state of Illinois. And he asked me specifically to sort of lay that out for him. I said I'd get back to him. It took a couple of weeks. By the time I got back to him, it was $8.6 billion that we had saved for the state of Illinois. That's real money. That's real service money for stuff like funding transportation infrastructure, for emergency management money for first responders, for education money. I can go on and on. There have been different approaches of trying to coerce us into an agenda by leveraging funding unconstitutionally. Most of the room is old enough to have experienced Schoolhouse Rock, where when we were in elementary school, we learned a little bit about separation of powers. But, I actually carry with me a couple of pocket constitutions in case that anybody wants like a refresher course. Because, it's interesting because Justice Roberts, in speaking to Georgetown law students, said last year that the rule of law is under threat. This is when the president was criticizing judges who would rule against him, even some judges that he had appointed. And And he also said in the same speech that, and I frequently disagree with Justice Roberts, right? This is my, one of a few times we're aligned. This and maybe the National Guard case, which we'll talk about in a bit. he also said that we need an enhanced civics education. And I think what he was saying is that if we're in this world where the President of the United States can be attacking the judiciary any time the judiciary rules against him, the only thing we have left to sort of protect the rule of law and the construct that our founders envisioned for the country is the people, if they're educated about that design. But if people are forgetting what they learned in elementary school, what they had to, many of us had to take in our eighth grade civics test, if we're, a lot of people are forgetting that, just the fundamentals. There's not a single lawsuit have we filed because of a policy difference with the President of the United States or with the federal government. Every lawsuit we filed because what he was trying to do, he was doing illegally and unconstitutionally.
Your book.
If Congress had decided to appropriate $8.6 billion less to the state of Illinois, I could complain about it, but I couldn't necessarily sue about it. But that's not how it was, the attempt to achieve it was being put forth.
And so much of that came to a head with Midway Blitz, with,
yeah,
you know, you just mentioned the National Guard case. Things have quieted down. That's not by chance. Here in Chicago, with immigration, with arrests, that's not by chance. Could you remind us? Because I think when things do quiet down, we tend to move on. And sometimes that's, hey, look over here, look over here. Could you remind us of what was going on a year ago, 2 years ago, and what has now come? And I think part of it is much of it is due to a win in the lawsuit that you have put forward.
Yeah. And I talk about that in the context of two things.
Yeah.
Because if you recall, the meme, Apocalypse Now meme, Chicago, what did it say? Chicago about to find out. The framing of the surge of the Blitz was to help to fight crime. And things were being framed as if we were challenging some of these efforts, that we were undermining the efforts of the federal government trying to help fight crime. Well, as I've already mentioned, we have had an ongoing partnership with the local offices, many of which are represented here. That did not stop during Midway Blitz. That preceded by years Midway Blitz, and it continues now. There's some real heroes within those respective agencies that have partnered with our office and local law enforcement offices on an ongoing basis. What we know is that more priority was put towards civil immigration enforcement than having fully funding those agencies to fight crime. So it was the opposite of the philosophy that was being communicated in that context. But also, I think the statistic that I saw, and I don't know if its accuracy, was that of the folks detained, about 81% did not have criminal backgrounds. So if you put that in the context...
81% of...
Those detained...
Those detained during the Midway Blitz. Okay.
Yeah. And There are professionals who have been tasked with immigration enforcement through both Democrat and Republican administrations who are good at doing that job and good at doing that job the way they're supposed to do it. And it's not, it doesn't come with all that fanfare and elevators, helicopters coming down and folks being the blitzes of sensitive places like schools and courthouses and so forth. There's been effective immigration enforcement through both Democrat and Republican administrations that are done the right way. And
how did your lawsuit help?
Well, there's two lawsuits, right, that touch the issue. One, there was a threat of deploying the National Guard. And I've got to shout out Chris Wells, who's here. Chris, wave your hand. Sarah Hunger. Chris argued our National Guard case before Judge Perry here in the district court. And if you all have not had an opportunity to read the Judge Perry's order, I really encourage you to do some pleasure reading. At least
summer's here on the beach, perhaps.
At least the first two pages. There, as you may recall, that both there was an order to deploy both the Texas and the Illinois National Guard. And in their pleadings, when we sued to stop the deployment, the federalization and the deployment, they claimed that there was a request to protect a federal court building. Well, the chief judge came out and said publicly there was never any such request. They claimed that there were a number of specific people who had attacked ICE officers, and with those specific people being named in their pleadings, there were no bills returned by grand juries, even live time while we were in the hearing room during notes were coming in. Another no bill. And people, lay people may not have an appreciation for this, because there's an old saying of how you can indict a ham sandwich, if you want. Grand jury proceedings are one-sided, right? You don't get to put forth a defense in a grand jury hearing. So it's pretty difficult to have cases that are well thought out and well supported ending up with a grand jury not indicting. There's been a lot of talk about that lately, but we've done that. Finally, there was an indication of by an individual that local law enforcement was doing an effective job of keeping maintaining the peace around immigration enforcement. And we just happened to have an email from that gentleman to our state police saying, thank you for doing an effective job of keeping the peace. And so there was a credibility problem at the outset. But what Judge Perry did, he really did a thoughtful job of thinking the case. And again, Chris Wells did a great job of arguing the case. And it was very intense. And the work, and I think Chris maybe had about 10 hours of sleep over 8 days in preparing for this case. So there's a lot of pressure. She referenced Federalist 29. And the conversation between the delegates, the delegates were debating how much power to give the federal government over the state's militia, and some delegates were arguing that we might have a situation one day that one state's militia be sent into another, and guy we've gotten to know from the Broadway musical, who was a big proponent of federal power, Alexander Hamilton. You know, that guy. Alexander Hamilton says that's preposterous. That would never happen. Fast forward, Chicago, Illinois, Texas. A grand jury being so, it was so really remarkable.
It didn't ultimately happen.
It did not happen. And
why?
So we attained a stay, and again, Sarah Hunger argued it was appealed to the Seventh Circuit, and I was there when Sarah argued the case before Seventh Circuit, and we maintained it there, and then it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And a lot of people have expressed, like, nervousness about this Supreme Court. And even the senator, when he was questioning me in the hearing, says, well, you know, it's really a waste of your time given what's going to happen ultimately in the Supreme Court. I'd be lying to say we weren't nervous about what the result might be. But we were successful with this Supreme Court of having that injunction stay in place, and the audacity of what was being sought by DOJ is something else. I mean, when the judge raised a question about the credibility issues, there was sort of a response of well, you know, that really doesn't matter that much. Those sort of facts on the ground, a dispute about the facts on the ground. The only thing that matters is the president and his perception, and that he has the ultimate authority to deploy the National Guard, sort of regardless of what the facts on the ground is. And so they were going for the full, and by the way, Judge, you have no role in this process whatsoever. This is just totally within the president's discretion. How dangerous that is if that case goes a different direction. It wasn't just about Chicago and the state of Illinois. It was about whether cities throughout the United States could be militarized, whether volunteers for National Guards, people who could be in this room, who volunteer to serve their country, are turned against citizens of the country. That's not the vision of the founders, and that's not what we should hope for in our country. So it had something to do. Its reach was far beyond just the question of immigration enforcement or crime. It's whether we're going to embrace a sort of an authoritarian approach of giving one man the ability to turn the country's military against whoever he wishes based on whatever he perceives. I know everybody thinks about it in the immigration context or in the fighting crime context. You know, not to mention that guardsmen are not trained to do day-to-day fighting of crime. They're law enforcement officers who are trained to do that work, and they're agents in the federal government who are trained to do that work. And those are the people who we should rely on to do that work. And they do it effectively.
Thank you for putting it into that context. I mean, we're approaching our 250th anniversary. I think 100 years from now, people are going to look back, and this is going to be a big piece of that. I mean, we saw what was happening in the city. We were waiting any day now for... I remember waking up to hearing helicopters and wondering what they were for.
Yeah.
And then it slowed down, and then ultimately, you know, for all of us, I'm not a lawyer, a lot of us aren't lawyers, many are, or involved deeply in law enforcement. So we know what we think is happening. We see what's happening in the news. We know what's right in front of us, as I said, and then something else comes up. All the work that was going on in the behind the scenes in the meantime that you just explained, I think not only set the stage for a safe and peaceful Chicago, but like you said, other cities. Ultimately, then we started seeing different federal officials stepping down or being fired. It sounds like some of that started here in Chicago.
We've benefited from that a little bit. We've got a lot of from the attrition of the federal government. We've picked up a lot of people and been able to staff ourselves as a result. One quick thing about what I said about law enforcement, and I appreciate the exercise of First Amendment and the willingness of people to want to do their part. While some of these civil immigration efforts have taken place, and a lot of people have, in doing so, vilified local law enforcement officers who are doing nothing but just trying to keep peace, and their ability to do so was very central to our ability to prevail in the National Guard case, because one of the allegations was that local law enforcement was not able to keep peace. So we have to be very careful at conflating, right? Secondly, while I'm a child of immigrants who made tremendous contributions to this country. My father was a physician, a community physician, who never turned back a patient because of their inability to pay. He was born in Haiti. And so that's in part why I'm very supportive of law-abiding immigrants who make great contributions to this country. That said, in our effort to protect those individuals, we shouldn't handicap our ability to deal with people who are committing violent crimes.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's not one-sided. I mean, there was a pretty clear case this summer this past spring with a student from Loyola brutally murdered by someone who came to Chicago illegally. Very clear case that, to me, again, I'm not an expert, where that potentially could have been avoided. Are we not arresting people who are criminals?
We are. We are. The question is, we do have a Trust Act that is meant to make sure that state and local law enforcement resources are not used for civil immigration enforcement. And it's our 10th Amendment. It grows out of a 10th Amendment anti-commandeering doctrine that we can't be forced by the federal government to do what is the federal government's work. That said, if there are individuals who have been apprehended, tried, and convicted of a certain very serious crimes that pose a danger to our community, we do have to seek out better ways of collaborating with our the federal government and with regards to dealing with those individuals. And that's something that our office has been committing ourselves to trying to solve that challenge. There's an ongoing conversation around that, and I'm personally committed to dealing with that situation, and it's consistent with my capacity to walk and chew gum. Right?
What a complex issue and case and all that comes with it. And I'd like to I actually want to address one more piece of that before we move on to some other topics. There was also the possibility of local law enforcement arresting or prosecuting federal law enforcement. You know, and it came up recently with our state's attorney.
Yep.
And she got some pushback on that. Where do you stand on that? Talk about complex. I mean, yep. Here we are sitting, and by the way, so encouraged by all the partners that we have in the room. That's a statement.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you saying that previous to some of these issues that we've had those partnerships, we continue clearly to, and there's so much more to come.
I think there's been unfair sort of criticism and judgment of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. I was in touch with Eileen when some of this discussion was taking place, and she developed a protocol. She was in touch with our office, and so we weighed in on the protocol, which of how you deal with supremacy for federal officers, and it's not a situation where that dictates that they're above the law, but there is more to navigate when you have somebody acting in the role of law enforcement. And so she put forth a protocol to be published to make clear of what that navigation looks like. One of the things that I was critical of is that to the extent that we're going to be critical of the President of the United States and alleging that he has used Pam Bondi in the past and perhaps Todd Blanche now to weaponize the Department of Justice and dictating, there's usually this perception of separation between the President and the Attorney General, not this Attorney General, but the federal Attorney General, that notwithstanding that the President appoints an Attorney General, that they're to act sort of independently. So there was much to be critical of the President saying Pam Bondi should prosecute this person or that person or the other person. To the extent that we're going to be critical of that, we should be critical of people locally saying that any state's attorney should prosecute folks, any public official saying the state's attorney should prosecute folks, unless you have personally evaluated all the evidence, all the legal hurdles, and can come to that conclusion. So
That's what we pay you for. As a taxpayer, yeah. Thank you for
It's always easy for somebody to just like watch the news and say, this person should be prosecuted, and it's just, why hasn't it happened yet? We get it, right? I personally have encountered a lot of criticism on the front of public corruption. And we get a lot of questions all the time. And media comes to me, my press staff comes to me because we're getting questions about this case or that case or another case. And we never want to comment if there's a potentially ongoing investigation, whether it's ours or whether it's that of a law enforcement partner of ours. or whether it's a combination of the two. That's stupid. That's plain stupid. If you, you know, you don't want to project, hey, here we're coming, by the way, hey, we're coming after you, you know.
But you mentioned, and actually that'll help, because I thank you for, again, it goes back to your day job and what's going on last, the federal accountability, and look how much we've had to dedicate to that. Your day job, public corruption is a piece of that, guns, drugs, all, you know, all the different things that we've talked about. I'd like to get into a few of those, and you actually mentioned something about the grand jury, because that was a question that came up. Mm-hmm. I always try to do my best to incorporate some questions that we've received from the audience. If you'll allow me, this is long, so I'm going to take half of it. Since the state of Illinois does not have a provision for statewide grand juries, the Illinois Attorney General's office in the past has been able to effectively prosecute public corruption. And then there are a few cases and history. And then the question, I think, is would you support legislation to enable statewide grand juries so that the Attorney General's office can credibly investigate public corruption?
Yeah. So
that came from Michael Rizzo.
Thank you, Michael. So first of all, the easy question to that is yes, and we participated on our reform committees several years ago that the legislature had put together, and our office made the recommendation to expand statewide grand jury authority to include public corruption. That said, since beginning of my tenure, we've been involved in prosecution of, I think, a couple of hundred public corruption cases. Not all elected officials, but, you know, other employees, whether it's PPP fraud. We've had several county elected officials where there would be a conflict with the state's attorney's office. We've stepped in and we've prosecuted those cases. And we've collaborated with law enforcement partners in the investigation of other public corruption cases. We can't, particularly with any ongoing investigations, we can't talk about it, right? And that doesn't make sense. But we support both in action or in referral such in investigations. Mm-hmm. We work to deconflict such that we're, law enforcement agencies are not stepping on each other's toes by investigating the same thing, because that can do a disservice to effective investigation. Notwithstanding there not being a provision in the Statewide Grand Jury Act, we've still been active. We're not unique in the state to have a situation where the most of the highest profile public corruption cases are prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's not an Illinois thing. That's not a unique thing. That's common across the country. But that's not to say that our office, state's attorney's offices, are not active in the space. So happens, you know, that there's the FBI is very effective in their investigative tools and in their capacity to do that work well. And you want the best agencies to tackle those problems.
You you weave in oftentimes collaboration. I know another priority of yours that has produced results is organized retail crime.
Yes.
You know, we represented the City Club, has many businesses, business owners, restaurants, you name it. So it's always a topic that we like to bring up and check in on. How's that going? What's
great.
The latest there?
And it's a great example of law enforcement collaboration from a lot of partners we have at the table, the FBI, Homeland Security Investigation, Secret Service, different states' attorneys' offices, local police departments. When I didn't know what organized retail crime was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and it was somebody from Home Depot that showed me on a laptop during the pandemic a criminal warehouse that looked like a hardware store. There's so many stolen items that were so well organized. I'm like, what? And so we did a tour. We had loss prevention experts from different brick and mortar retail entities, and many of whom were former federal law enforcement officers. We went around the state and we convened state's attorneys and sheriff's departments and police departments. And at first there was a little bit of resistance. What, you want us to focus on retail theft? I said, no, not retail theft, kind of retail theft on steroids. This is organized retail crime, the proceeds of which fund other criminal activity, human trafficking, gun trafficking,
who is
terrorism.
At the top of this?
It depends on what ring you're talking about. It happens at all levels. So it could be international. I think it was either New Mexico or Arizona AG's office that was involved with a bus where they were following around this one woman who was had organized what looked like a ragtag crew that was going around stealing wine, steak, and tequila. And so if you look at them as one-offs, it's nothing, but in the end, she'd stolen over $1 million worth of wine, steak, and tequila. And then you start asking, well, what are you doing with that wine, steak, and tequila? They were sending it back to Mexico to the cartel for distribution in the villages. And so it is, it's comprehensive. We had a bus where I think it was in the Metro East, Tom, I have the other Tom Dart, right? Not Sheriff Tom Dart, but my chief.
We will have Sheriff Tom Dart here at City Club in July, though, so you're Tom Dart.
Yeah, but there's a pretty badass Tom Dart here today. He's my chief investigator, who actually is a former ATF agent. And we had a bust, and I think in the Metro East, that involved a former police chief that was head of a ring. And so we've had pawn shops involved that we've raided. And we had one that arose out of a CPD arrest of an individual at a nightclub, that when they arrested him, they discovered boxes of leggings in his car and a list of storage facilities. So we got a search warrant for those storage facilities and recovered, I don't know, it was close to $2 million worth of stolen. We had to borrow an IDOT warehouse to store all the stuff that was 9 semis full of stolen stuff. So we've had some success since announcing that we had an organized retail crime task force. Now, my confession, when I announced that I had an organized retail crime task force, we really didn't know exactly what we were doing. You know, I just wanted to say, hey, we got a task force and we're going to work on this. But it's worked out and we've worked hard on it. And it's really a good sign of collaboration between state, local, and federal partners. Another area which is just a growing and area that should worry all of us, particularly those of us who are parents or grandparents of young children, is we out of In 101 counties, we run the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. And the number of cyber tips of potential possession and dissemination of child pornography has grown, and it keeps growing, and it does require multi-agency collaboration to tackle this problem. We have this cool van that when we execute these search warrants, we can grab the hard drive and take it right out to the van and immediately start processing it. And a lot of police departments, I know Tim Diamond wanted me to mention this for sure. Tim is chief of my criminal justice division. A lot of police departments have these dogs that could sniff out little drives that sometimes they'll dump off, you know. And a lot of it is that, just like in the movies, the creepy guy in the basement. But, you know, we've arrested, I don't know, I asked the figure, I asked Deborah for the figure, so I'll cheat. Or Deborah, you can yell it out. Well, I think we've, during my tenure, we've arrested 1,300 individuals. And the thing about this, you know, when you say it was just possession of child pornography, a lot of these individuals admit to be hand-on abusers. And so in addition to arresting them for possession of child pornography, we also remove children from dangerous situations where they could be preyed upon. And, you know, oftentimes, I know when I was being raised, you know, my parents would say, come in before dark, and would feel comfortable that, you know, I'm in the house. And these days, when your kid's in the house and you see them, they're playing a video game or on the computer, and you think they're safe. They got those headsets on, they're talking to somebody, and you don't know who they're talking to. And you don't know what they're disclosing. And that's the growing danger that we are collaborating to fight.
We're going to have to get more into that next time, because that's some scary stuff. This is just a sampling of what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I there are many things I didn't even touch on the topics. Just a sampling of what you're up to. So much of it is out of the movies. But clearly there's been some success. Obviously more to be done.
This was the last thing. I just really want to lift up the both my staff again, but also the law enforcement partners, particularly the federal law enforcement partners, local federal law enforcement partners, for being able to rise up above just sort of the conflict that would otherwise have us separated. You know, we have continued through all of this sort of conflict to collaborate on fighting crime, and it's something that should be applauded for these respective leaders.
Yeah, let's leave it at that. We will certainly applaud collaboration, all these law enforcement officials that are doing great things, that are working together. And so many of them are doing that under your leadership, Attorney General. So thank you. 10 years healthy now from cancer,
I hear,
too. Basketball again, hopefully.
Yeah, playing basketball. A few months early. I got hip surgery last fall, but I've been playing a lot. Folks who know me know that I'm a maniac on the basketball court, but it is my stress release.
Well, stay healthy. We need your leadership.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody. Attorney General Kwame Raoul, you're always welcome back. Thanks.